From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The press and the business community and the political institutions are all geared to the establishment. And when they're really tested, they're all militarists.
Former anti-war presidential candidate Eugene McCarthy. Hundreds gathered for his memorial service this weekend. We'll speak with a reporter who covered him for decades and SDS founder Tom Hayden. And we'll remember another man of the Vietnam War era, Hugh Thompson, a former Army helicopter pilot. He helped rescue Vietnamese civilians from fellow U.S. troops during the My Lai Massacre, 1968.
I'm just real sorry that my crew could not have done more. I'm extremely sorry for my fellow Americans for what happened. It wasn't right. It wasn't war. I pray to God something like this never happens again.
And selling the Amazon for a handful of beads. We'll look at secret contracts between big oil and the Ecuadorian military. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The captors of kidnapped U.S. journalist in Iraq have threatened to kill her unless U.S. forces release all female prisoners in the country. On Tuesday, the Arabic television network Al Jazeera broadcast a videotape of Jill Carroll, a 28-year-old freelance reporter working for the Christian Science Monitor. It was the first time she's been seen since she was seized in Baghdad earlier this month. The video contained no audio. Al Jazeera says the captors identified themselves as members of the previously unknown group, the Brigades of Vengeance. The group gave a 72-hour deadline for the U.S. to comply with their demand. In other Iraq news, 10 Iraqi security workers were killed today in an ambush on their convoy in Baghdad. A Malawian engineer working for the Iraqi telecom company Irakna was kidnapped in the attack, and another engineer from Madagascar was reported missing. Meanwhile, on Tuesday, gunmen shot dead 7 people working as food supply workers for the Iraqi army. Here in the United States, New York Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton is drawing criticism from Republicans after comparing their control over Congress to a plantation.
When you look at the way the House of Representatives has been run, it has been run like a plantation, and you know what I'm talking about.
Republicans immediately denounced Clinton for making what House Speaker Dennis Hastert called a racist comment. But Al Sharpton, who hosted Clinton's speech, defended the remark, saying he'd already made the same comparison. During the speech, Senator Clinton also lashed out at the Bush administration.
I predict to you that this administration will go down in history as one of the worst that has ever governed our country.
Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton speaking on Martin Luther King Day in Harlem. In Afghanistan, 22 people have died in one of the biggest suicide bombings the country has seen since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. The attack in the border town of Spinbaldak left another 27 people seriously injured. In a statement to Agence France-Presse, a man claiming to speak on behalf of the Taliban denied the group's involvement, saying the Taliban does not target civilians. The attacks followed 2 separate suicide bombings in just over 24 hours that killed at least 6 people, including a Canadian diplomat. In other news, the U.S. government has refused to express regret over last week's CIA bombing in Pakistan. The attack killed a reported 17 people, including women and children. The U.S. has said little about the bombing, but it is believed to have been carried out by a CIA Predator drone. On Tuesday, State Department spokesperson Sean McCormick told reporters only, quote, "The United States clearly values innocent human life. That's why we're fighting the war on terror," he said. Meanwhile, Pakistani officials said Tuesday the strike had killed up to 5 suspected militants. In Lebanon, nearly 10,000 students marched on the U.S. embassy near Beirut to denounce what they called Washington's interference in their country. The students chanted slogans including "America out" and "Death to America." The protest came 3 days after police clashed with anti-U.S. demonstrators at a smaller protest in downtown Beirut. The U.S. has sided with anti-Syrian groups in Lebanon and pushed for the disarmament of Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. embassy denied a report in a Lebanese newspaper that said it had pushed for the firing of Shiite ministers, including 2 from Hezbollah. The embassy says the story had been invented in order to provoke tensions in Lebanon. In Europe, a Swiss senator has said there's no longer any question that the CIA undertook illegal activities in Europe by secretly transporting and jailing terrorists. The official, Dick Marty, is heading up a European investigation into allegations that the CIA operated secret prisons in Poland and Romania. He also said blame has to be placed on all European nations who have helped the U.S. carry out its covert operations.
I'd like it to be clear that the problem does not only concern Romania and Poland. It would be too simple to criminalize these two countries. I think it's the whole of Europe that accepted to keep quiet. Because if it's true that something happened in Romania and Poland, something else also happened in many other countries, and many of them were certainly aware of what was going on. And to me, in such a situation, knowing and keeping quiet is as bad as tolerating that such activities be led on its territory.
That was Swiss Senator Dick Marty. Last week, a Swiss newspaper published the text of an intercepted Egyptian memo about U.S. interrogation centers in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. The memo had been faxed from the Egyptian Foreign Ministry to the Egyptian embassy in London, but it had been intercepted by the Swiss Secret Service and then leaked to the press. In Haiti, two Jordanian troops with the UN mission were killed Tuesday in a gun battle in the poor neighborhood of Cité Soleil. UN troops have stepped up armed raids on Cité Soleil amidst pressure from business leaders and foreign officials. In Britain, the British government has denied allegations that a memo detailing a conversation between Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush includes talk of bombing the Arabic television network Al Jazeera. The denial came as the Blair government turned down Al Jazeera's request for access to the memo. A Blair spokesperson declined to say what the memo contained. The two men who leaked the document, a British civil servant and a parliamentary researcher, are facing charges for passing on classified government information. And in this country, the Supreme Court has voted to protect Oregon's one-of-a-kind assisted suicide law, blocking a Bush administration initiative that would have punished doctors who helped put terminally ill patients to death. The court ruled former Attorney General John Ashcroft acted improperly when he invoked a federal drug law to pursue Oregon doctors for overprescribing lethal doses of prescription medicines. Oregon's landmark law has been used to end the lives of over 200 people. The ruling marked the first loss for Chief Justice John Roberts, who was joined in his dissent by Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. In New Orleans, a federal judge has approved a settlement that forces the city to give residents at least 7 days' advance notice of any house demolitions. The settlement resolves a lawsuit launched by residents last month following newspaper reports the city planned to demolish over 2,500 homes without notice. Meanwhile, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, has increased its count of people displaced from the Gulf Coast by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita to 2 million people, an increase by nearly a third. FEMA attributes the increase to an earlier reporting error. FEMA says it's paying rental assistance to over 685,000 families, an increase of 32% over a month ago. And in other news, the New York Times is reporting a high-level Bush administration intelligence assessment concluded in early 2002 that the sale of enriched uranium from Niger to Iraq was, quote, unlikely. The claim, since discredited, that Iraq sought to purchase the uranium played a key role in the Bush administration's attempts to justify the invasion of Iraq. The Times reports a secret memo by State Department intelligence analysts concluded the sale was improbable for several reasons, including that it would have required Niger to send 25 hard-to-conceal 10-ton tractor trailers filled with uranium across 1,000 miles and at least one international border. A Bush administration official interviewed by the New York Times would not say whether President Bush saw the memo before he made the Niger claim in his infamous State of the Union address in January 2003, over 10 months after the intelligence assessment was made. And in Washington, the Bush administration is refusing to reveal details of its meetings with scandal-plagued lobbyist Jack Abramoff. On Tuesday, White House spokesperson Scott McClellan acknowledged Abramoff had a few staff-level meetings with White House officials, but he would not say with whom Abramoff met, which interests he was representing, or how he got access to the White House, telling reporters, quote, "We are not going to engage in a fishing expedition." Abramoff pleaded guilty earlier this month to conspiracy, mail fraud, and tax evasion as part of a corruption scandal that's implicated a number of Republican lawmakers and their aides. And in Texas, a 55-year-old former Marine has been arrested for avoiding military service in the Vietnam War. Ernest McQueen, born Ernest Johnson Jr., fled his North Carolina military base in 1969, over 36 years ago. McQueen told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram Monday his desertion was motivated by news of the My Lai massacre of Vietnamese civilians, growing anti-war protests in the U.S., and disturbing stories he'd heard from returning Marines. McQueen said, quote, "I just decided I didn't want to be part of killing anybody. That's as plain as I can say it," he said. McQueen is currently in a Texas prison. He could face up to 3 years in jail. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Those are the headlines. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to look at the lives of two men whose actions during the late 60s shaped how this country viewed the Vietnam War. One was Hugh Thompson. He was an Army helicopter pilot who helped stop the My Lai massacre when U.S. troops slaughtered hundreds of innocent Vietnamese villagers. He died earlier this month at the age of 62. Later in the program, we'll speak with former Army Specialist Lawrence Colburn, who helped Thompson end the massacre. But first, we're going to look at the life of Eugene McCarthy. The former Minnesota senator and presidential candidate died in December at the age of 89. On Saturday, some 800 people filled the National Cathedral in Washington for a memorial service. McCarthy and the Vietnam War will be forever linked. It was in 1968 when the Democratic senator from Minnesota broke party ranks and decided to challenge President Lyndon Johnson for the party's presidential nomination. McCarthy ran on a platform opposing the Vietnam War. By 1968, the war had already taken thousands of American lives as U.S. involvement escalated under Johnson. In March 1968, voters in New Hampshire responded to McCarthy's anti-war sentiments. He shocked the nation by receiving 42% of the primary vote. Johnson, the sitting president, ended up winning the New Hampshire primary, but his political future changed overnight. Within days, Senator Robert Kennedy jumped into the race, and then, to the amazement of the country, Johnson announced within weeks he was dropping out and not seeking re-election. 1968 would prove to be a painful year in many ways. On April 4th, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Then on June 6th, Robert Kennedy was shot dead shortly after delivering a victory speech in Los Angeles after winning the California primary. For many, Eugene McCarthy's run for president marked a bright spot in a tragic year. But McCarthy's run for the presidency stopped in Chicago during the infamous 1968 Democratic Convention, when the delegates nominated Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who would then go on to lose to Richard Nixon in November. But the effects of McCarthy's run for office were felt for years. On Saturday at McCarthy's memorial service, President Clinton gave the eulogy for the late senator and said McCarthy was instrumental in building opposition to the Vietnam War. Clinton said, quote, "It all began with Gene McCarthy's willingness to stand alone and turn the tide of history." We go back now to 1968 to listen to an anti-Vietnam War campaign radio spot that McCarthy ran ahead of the New Hampshire primary.
4 years ago, America had 3,000 men in Vietnam, and we were told we were winning the war. 3 years ago, we had 16,000 men in Vietnam, and we were told we were winning the war. 2 years ago, we had 100,000 men in Vietnam, and we were told we were winning the war. A year ago, we had 250,000 men in Vietnam, and we were told we were winning the war. Today, we have 550,000 men in Vietnam with over 100,000 boys killed and wounded, and we're told we're winning the war. There's got to be a better way than death, double talk, and taxes. On March 12th, stand up with McCarthy and say so.
A campaign radio spot that Eugene McCarthy ran ahead of the New Hampshire primary in 1968. This is an excerpt of a campaign speech by McCarthy.
And it fits into our whole campaign thrust, namely of protecting people's rights and beyond that of setting them free. We'll go on and great things and also in small things to demonstrate our continued belief that There is a certain power in human reason, which is really the only instrument we have with which we can give some direction to life and history.
That was Eugene McCarthy. As we turn now to our guests, on the phone with us from California is Tom Hayden, former California state senator, led the demonstrations at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention. Hayden and others were charged with conspiracy and inciting to riot in the famous trial known as Chicago 7. And in our studio in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Robert Isley. He is co-founder and editor-at-large of the Hill newspaper in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a dual biography of Hubert Humphrey and former Senator Eugene McCarthy called Almost to the Presidency, written in 1979. He was Washington correspondent for the St. Paul Dispatch and Pioneer Press and Knight Ritter before becoming press secretary to Vice President Walter Mondale. We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Albert Isley, can you talk about when you first met Eugene McCarthy?
Yes, I can. I came here to Washington in 1965 as a reporter for newspapers in Duluth and St. Paul, and obviously he was in the Senate, and I covered him and other members of the Minnesota delegation. I had known him somewhat because I happened to have graduated from the same university in Minnesota that he did, St. John's University, so he was obviously well known there. But I really got to know him in the period from 65 on when I covered him as a senator.
When did you start to talk to him about his desire to run for president against the sitting Democratic president?
Well, it was becoming evident in 1967 that he was seriously considering it. As you recall, there were a number of other senators who were critical of the war and who had been asked by anti-war activists to run, and none of them wanted to. I believe I wrote the first story that he was actually seriously considering challenging Lyndon Johnson. This was in late 1967, and he, in November or maybe December 1st, first part of December of 67, he gave a speech in Chicago in which he basically said that he was challenging Johnson. Of course, he announced his candidacy later. It's when you look back on it, it's hard to understand just how courageous, if you will, and maybe foolhardy it was for a senator of the Democratic Party to challenge a Democratic president, one of the most powerful presidents ever. It was akin to political suicide, but as it turned out, it certainly wasn't.
Tom Hayden, when Eugene McCarthy announced he would run for president, where were you? If you can remember.
Well, that would have been towards the end of 1967. I would have been on the East Coast in Newark, New Jersey. The country was coming apart in the town where I was working, Newark. There had been several days of rioting and people killed, the same in Detroit. The Tet Offensive had not occurred yet in Vietnam, but it was clear that the war was being lost or had become a quagmire, and there was a huge movement, I mean, a really huge movement, and an element of it wanted to find a candidate to challenge President Johnson. You wonder about the parallels with today. And McCarthy came forward after a lot of thought. I remember seeing him in the scruffy headquarters of the National Mobilization Committee coming by to say hello to people. And I was very young, and he was very elegant. He had a black coat, suit, and tie. And a lot of people rallied to him. I was not one of them. I was involved with the anti-war movement, and come what may, we wanted to have demonstrations in the streets, there probably was an electoral strategy, I thought. And looking back, I have to say that he was the man. He really did. President Clinton is right. He did take it on all alone at a time when a lot of the counsel was that it was suicidal, and he generated a movement that toppled a president and brought into politics the whole generation of activists that included people like the young Bill Clinton, who I think was his campaign manager in Texas.
Can you talk about why Albert Eisley, Robert Kennedy, entered the race and what this meant for Eugene McCarthy, the man you were covering?
Well, it certainly caused a huge upheaval in the Democratic Party. You recall that Robert Kennedy had been implored by others to run and refused to do it before New Hampshire and before Johnson announced that he was dropping out. And immediately afterwards, Robert Kennedy announced that he was getting in, which alienated many of his supporters and certainly McCarthy supporters as well. And then, of course, that led to the series of tragic events which you referred to earlier, his assassination in California when he won the primary. But he didn't win it by that much. Just the week before that, McCarthy had won the Oregon primary, so it was a real race going into California. Then that touched off a whole series of cataclysmic events, culminating with the violent Chicago convention, and then Hubert Humphrey's defeat by Richard Nixon. Many of McCarthy's critics blame him for Humphrey's defeat, but I don't think that's right. I think the biggest reason that Humphrey lost that election was that he could not get the albatross of Vietnam off of his back, and I think that he McCarthy reached out to him at various times and asked him to make some concessions, which he wouldn't, and for that reason, I think that he lost the election by a very slim margin, obviously.
We're talking to Albert Eisley and to Tom Hayden about Eugene McCarthy. Memorial service held for him this week in Washington. Over 800 people attended. We'll come back to this discussion and then also talk about another man of the Vietnam War era, Hugh Thompson, who tried to intervene in to stop the killing of Vietnamese civilians, intervene to stop U.S. troops from killing Vietnamese civilians. Stay with us.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a walk in that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me.
This Land is Your Land by Woody Guthrie. The song was sung on Saturday at Eugene McCarthy's memorial service. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We are talking to Albert Eisley, who is the founder of the Hill newspaper, also covered Eugene McCarthy for decades. And we're joined on the phone by Tom Hayden, well-known 60s activist, also became a California state senator, has written a number of books. We're going to turn now to an interview that Eugene McCarthy did with Minnesota Public Radio in March 25th, 2003, just after the U.S. invaded Iraq.
The Bush administration is sort of like an intruder. He doesn't care whether what he does is legal or traditional or not. He just goes ahead and does it, and there's nothing you can do about it unless you call out the Air Force or the Army, and they're busy. I don't know, half a dozen of our institutions have been not destroyed, but undercut. The Supreme Court has been corrupted. The Army has been corrupted. The Vice Presidential Office has been corrupted. And Bush almost said, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, what are you going to do to me? Put me in jail?
Eugene McCarthy, speaking just after the U.S. invaded Iraq. Albert Eisley, you followed Eugene McCarthy. You wrote a book about Eugene McCarthy and Hubert Humphrey. what happened to him after 1968, after his run for the presidency? What about his career?
That's a good question. He spent almost 35 years as a very public private citizen after he left office in 1970, after he left the Senate. He remained very much a public figure. He ran for president three or four more times, including twice as an independent. But I think, as his comments in the Minnesota Public Radio interview indicated, it was consistent with his feeling that that Congress needed to put limits on presidential power. He opposed the personalization of the office of the presidency. He felt that there should be more congressional oversight than the CIA and the FBI and so forth. And he spoke out and wrote almost 20 books. He spoke out on those issues and others throughout the rest of his career.
We're going to go now to another clip of Eugene McCarthy talking about the corporate media.
But I figured after 92, when the control over what was really communicated was left in the hands of corporately controlled television, and the projection then becomes one of the corporate morality and corporate mentality. So you're backed up to where the kind of ultimate controlling at the beginning is whatever is in the corporate mind. And it feeds out through the whole society until we're sort of all co-opted. I don't know how you fight your way out of it.
Eugene McCarthy in the documentary made about him called I'm Sorry, I'm Right. Tom Hayden, your response.
Well, I think it's well worth remembering that he was a forerunner on what became the issue of campaign reform, political reform. He represented a kind of an independent third force in politics that now and then surfaces in the Democratic Party and presidential primaries and third-party candidates. But his contribution was this poetic notion. He prided himself on being more interested in poetry than politics. This poetic notion that the young people of this country being drafted, resisting the draft, being dragged off to Vietnam, needed a voice in the wilderness. And one wonders what it takes to have that kind of character, that kind of whimsical approach to politics, in a sense. Space for a whole movement that upset a presidency and was ultimately successful in challenging a war. And nobody can take that from him.
Again, Eugene McCarthy.
Eisenhower's final warning was about the military-industrial complex. And what he didn't say, you know, was that it developed while he was president.
We can prevent...
The first sign that something was happening was about 1947. It was after the war. It was before I went to Congress, but it was an appropriation bill with a new name. They called it the Department of Defense. The war had been fought under the direction of the War Department. But somewhere after the war, somebody, and I tried to find out from the Pentagon, I said, how did that word change come in? And they just said, it just came up in that appropriation. I said, well, things don't happen that way. I've been on committees, and somebody had to say, let's change the name. And they would never admit who had done it and how it had happened. So since that time, we never conduct wars now. It's just national defense. And if you have a War Department, some person might say, where's the war? And I say, well, we don't have one. Well, are you planning one? No, we're not planning one. But if you have a Defense Department, you say, defense, there's a threat. Or if it isn't real now, it will be. So it's a covering title for unlimited defense. There's no limit to, it's kind of Kafka-like. You can always hear a scratching sound. And when they finally got us so defended on Earth, in the Reagan administration, they said, it's out there. Space defense. So it goes to infinity. You can never have enough defense. You can always hear a scratching sound, internal, external, inner space, outer space, on Earth, wherever it comes from.
Eugene McCarthy. I want to thank our guests, Albert Isley, who covered Eugene McCarthy for decades. You're going out to Minnesota to deliver a eulogy.
I am at Senator McCarthy's alma mater, St. John's University, and there will be another one the next day at St. Thomas College in St. Paul, where he taught.
And Tom Hayden, want to thank you as well, former California State Senator at the 1968 Chicago Democratic Convention on the outside. And today we'll end the segment on Eugene McCarthy with Eugene McCarthy's own words.
I wrote a book, a poem on courage after 60. And I keep, you know, it carries on. It gets, you get more courage after 70 and so on. It says, now it's certain there's no magic stone to be found. And no secrets. One must go with the mind's winnowed learning, no more than a child's handhold on a willow bending over the lake, or a sumac root at the edge of the cliff. All ignorance is checked, all betrayal scratched. The coat has been hung on the peg, the cigar laid on the beveled table's edge, the cue chosen in chalk, the balls racked for the final break. All cards have been drawn, all bets called, the dice warm as blood in the hand, shaken for the final cast. The glove has been thrown on the ground, the last choice of weapons made, a book for one poem, a poem for one line, a line for one word. Broken things are powerful, but things about to break are stronger still. The last shot from the brittle bow is the truest.
Eugene McCarthy from the film I'm Sorry, I Was Right. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to another American figure of the Vietnam War, Hugh Thompson. As a helicopter pilot, he helped rescue Vietnamese civilians from fellow U.S. troops during the My Lai massacre. Hugh Thompson died last week of cancer. He was 62 years old. On March 16, 1968, Thompson and two other crew members landed their helicopter in front of U.S. troops firing on Vietnamese civilians in the village of My Lai. They pointed their guns at their fellow service members to prevent more killing and helped evacuate the villagers. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by one of Thompson's crew members. But first, we take a look at exactly what happened on that day, March 16, 1968. We turn to an edited excerpt of a documentary produced by Mike Baim called The Sound of the Violin in My Lai.
Hugh Thompson was a helicopter pilot in the U.S. Army. Lawrence Colburn, a dog gunner, and Glenn Andrott, a navigator. They were flying over this field in the morning of March 16, 1968. From above, they looked down and just could not believe what they saw. The American soldiers were herding the village women and children into a ditch and opened fire on them. Shot, the team flew to the village. Thompson saw a little wounded girl in the field. He dropped a smoke flare for medical assistance. A U.S. captain ran to the place and shot her dead. Then they saw a group of American soldiers chasing about 10 farmers. They landed the helicopter right in front of the pursuing soldiers. Thompson ordered the dog gunner to point his machine gun at the soldiers and said that it would shoot if the soldiers moved forward. Then Thompson ordered two-wheel helicopters to land and get the farmers to safety. When the crew flew along a ditch, Andrutta saw something moving along a heap of dead bodies. Thompson landed his helicopter. Andrutta waded through the bodies and picked up a little boy, all covered in blood, but was still alive. They took him to Quang Ngai Hospital. That year, Colbert was only 19 and Thompson was 25. According to the American media, in 1969, Thompson refused to take a Flying Cross medal because he thought that the U.S. Army wanted to buy his silence. 30 years later, the U.S. government did the right thing. They respectfully awarded the soldiers' medal to Thompson, Colburn, and Andrutta for their bravery. Andrutta did not live to get his medal. He died in the battle just 3 weeks after he had saved the little boy. The only American casualty on that day was a black soldier, Herbert Carter, who could not stand such mad killing. He shot himself in the foot so that he could not have to take part in the massacre. Herbert later related. I saw an old man standing in the middle of the rice field, waving at us in a friendly manner, but they shot him. I saw no victim in the village, only poor farmers running away from their burning huts, and then they shot them dead. Mrs. Lee is lucky. She was one of the rare survivors of the massacre. This is the memorial stele for 102 people, mostly women and children, who were killed along this road that day. Hubble's nervous system must have been made of steel to be able to take these pictures. A baby was killed, still hanging on its dead mother's breast. Mrs. Lee and her son were spared because they buried themselves under the bodies of three or four villagers. Nearby, her nephew Chung Bun was laying on top of his brother Chung Nam to shield him from the bullets. Both of them were killed. Mrs. Nung and Sister Nyang are also survivors of the massacre, but their survival was somewhat special. They were saved by the helicopter crew, Hugh Thompson, Larry Colburn, and Glenn Andriotta. We survived because these Americans waved to us and took us on their helicopter. Thanks to them, I'm still alive today. They shot like mad then. When they came, I ran for the shelter. A helicopter landed near us. The men waved and we came out. They pushed us onto the ship and took off. We were dead scared. Were they going to drop us into the sea? After some time, the helicopter landed and they signaled us to run away. It was only then that we knew we had been saved.
There's a lot of anger. And anger.
This is Hugh Thompson.
The Vietnamese people is directed at my fellow soldiers who went crazy that day. And I'm just real sorry that my crew could not have done more. I'm extremely sorry for my fellow Americans for what happened. It wasn't right. It wasn't war. And I pray to God something like this never happens again.
Hugh Thompson in an edited excerpt from the documentary The Sound of the Violin and Me Lie, produced by Mike Baim. Thompson and Lawrence Colburn later testified at the court-martial hearings for the massacre of over 300 civilians at My Lai. Only one U.S. soldier, platoon commander Lieutenant William Calley, was convicted. He was court-martialed and sentenced to life in prison for his role in the massacre. Many around the country viewed Calley as a scapegoat. Rallies for Calley were held all over the country, and Jimmy Carter, then the governor of Georgia, urged citizens to leave car headlights on to show support for him. President Richard Nixon later commuted Calley's sentence to 3 years house arrest. Thompson, on the other hand, was shunned for years by fellow soldiers. He received death threats and was once told by a Congress member that he was the only American who should be punished over My Lai. Although the My Lai massacre became one of the most infamous atrocities of the Vietnam War, little was known about Hugh Thompson's actions for decades. In 1998, Thompson and his two crew members, Lawrence Colburn and Glenn Andriotta, were awarded the Soldier's Medal, the highest U.S. military award for bravery not involving conflict with an enemy. Andriotta's award was posthumous. He was killed in Vietnam less than a month after My Lai. Thompson died last week after a prolonged battle with cancer. Lawrence Colburn was at his bedside when he died. He joins us now from a studio in Atlanta. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Larry Colburn.
Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. As we go back to that infamous day, can you tell us from your perspective, flying in the helicopter, what happened, what you saw below?
Well, early in the morning, we were one of the first American units on station ahead of the Americans that would be inserted on the ground. And it started out as a routine air support and reconnaissance mission. But as the day progressed, we noticed, obviously, that we weren't receiving any fire. Our job was to fly low level and try to entice people into giving up their positions by firing on us, and that wasn't happening. We saw people leaving the village. It was a Saturday morning, so it wasn't uncommon for the people to go to market on Saturday morning. So we thought it was good that these women and children and elderly people were leaving the area. And as we progressed around the perimeter of the area that the troops were being inserted into, we found nothing as far as resistance. At some point, we had to go refuel, and it was so quiet that morning that we didn't even call a backup team to cover us while we were refueling. And then when we came back from refueling, we started finding the same people that were leaving the area on the road out of the village were now dead on the road and in the ditches. And Mr. Thompson tried to piece together different scenarios. He knew it wasn't artillery because that had happened earlier in the morning. There were other gunships on station, but they weren't firing on the villagers. Finally, after marking a few bodies with smoke for medical assistance, we witnessed a captain approach a wounded woman and walked up to her and kicked her with his foot, stepped back, and blew her away. Then we realized what was going on and exactly who was doing the killing.
And so what did you do?
Mr. Thompson landed by the ditch where there were probably 150, 200 people dead or dying. And there was an American soldier standing there. We actually landed the aircraft because the communication was so bad. He physically got out of the aircraft, went over and spoke to the soldier and explained to him these were obviously civilians. There were no weapons captured. There were no draft age males. These are civilians. We need to help them out. And the soldier agreed and said he'd help them out. And as we lifted off again, we heard automatic weapons fire, and he was firing into the ditch again. So at that point, Glenn Andriotta spotted an earthen-type bunker with some faces peering out of it. And there was an approaching squad of Americans. Mr. Thompson decided, and we all decided, that if we didn't do something within the next 30 seconds, these people would die. So he landed the aircraft in between the advancing American troops and the people in the bunker, went over and spoke to a lieutenant and told him, or asked him, how we could get these people out of the bunker. They were obviously civilians. And the lieutenant replied he'd get them out with hand grenades. Mr. Thompson, who was outranked by this lieutenant, actually gave the lieutenant an order, told him to keep his people in place. He had a better idea. And I think he told him, if you fire on these people when I'm getting them out of the bunker, my people will fire on you. So he went over to the bunker himself and coaxed the villagers out. And we thought there were two or three. There were nine or ten. And we were in a small three-place helicopter, and all three seats were occupied, so we had to call down a gunship and use it as a medevac to remove these people from the area, take them down the road, and then the gunship came back on station. After that, we went back to the ditch. Glenn Andriotta spotted movement in the ditch. Mr. Thompson landed again. Glenn and I got out of the aircraft, went to the ditch. By the time I got there, Glenn was already in the ditch. He retrieved a small child and handed the child up to me. And we carried the child to a hospital orphanage a few miles away. And Mr. Thompson left the child with a nun and let her know that his family was probably all gone. So take care of him.
You were with Hugh Thompson at his bedside when he died?
Yes, ma'am.
And you were the last of the three of you surviving. Glenn Andriotta died in Vietnam right after My Lai. Your thoughts today about the action you took, just in introducing you, talking about the Congress member saying to Hugh Thompson, you're the only one who should be prosecuted for me lie.
I believe that was Mendel Rivers. Well, it had a toll on Hugh. He was tormented by not only Milai, but the way he was treated when he just told the truth and did what was morally right. People came after him and tried to discredit him. He was ostracized and in the military, but he never turned his back on them. He stayed in the military. His message would be how important it is to maintain integrity and honor and honesty within the ranks of the military.
You returned with Hugh Thompson. You returned to Vietnam. You returned to My Lai and the whole area. And you met with the survivors, the people that you saved.
Yes, and their offspring, yes.
Can you talk about what that was like?
If there was any gratification, it would have been that, to see that people actually did survive and they carried on and continued their families. We were also reunited with the boy from the ditch in 2001, which was incredible that they were able to find this boy. I prayed over the years that he was too young to remember or too traumatized to remember what had happened, but I misjudged his age. He was so small. He was 8 years old. I thought he was 4 or 5, and he remembered everything. We quizzed him a little bit, and only he could remember what happened. So we know it was the same boy.
Larry Colburn, we read in the headlines at the top of the program about a 55-year-old former Marine who's been arrested for avoiding military service in the Vietnam War. His name is Ernest McQueen, born Ernest Johnson Jr., fled his North Carolina military base in 69, over 36 years ago. He told the Fort Worth Star-Telegram on Monday that his desertion was motivated by news of the My Lai massacre. He now sits in a jail in Texas. Your thoughts about him?
I didn't know about that. I thought there was a blanket amnesty back in the 70s. Jimmy Carter administration. Wouldn't he fall into that category somehow? This is news to me.
He's now in in military custody, could face up to 3 years in jail. He said, I just decided I didn't want to be part of killing anybody. That's as plain as I can say it, he said.
Well, if he probably should have gone conscientious objector and possibly avoided this later on. But I'd like to be in contact with him if I could.
Well, we'll give you whatever information we have after the show. Finally, I wanted to ask, as you see what's happening in Iraq, as you see the photos from Abu Ghraib, hear about Guantanamo, what are your thoughts from your experience in Vietnam and dealing with, well, fellow U.S. soldiers at My Lai?
Well, if I were to continue on where Eugene McCarthy left off, we were warned about the military-industrial complex. It almost sounds cliche now to bring it up, but we're actually living it now. When we've taken resources away from social programs, healthcare, education, and all of those resources are directed toward defense, that's the way the country's going to go. And until the social elite have to send their own children to war, things won't change. They're good at sending other people's children to war, but if they had to send their own, we may not be where we are now.
Larry Colburn, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Larry Colburn, a helicopter gunner serving with Hugh Thompson in the Vietnam War, March 16, 1968, helped rescue residents of the Vietnamese village of My Lai as U.S. troops gunned down civilians there, speaking to us from Atlanta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love.
What's going on? Marvin Gaye here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to Ecuador and look at secret negotiations between the military and big oil to extract oil from the Ecuadorian rainforest. A new article posted on Alternet website entitled Selling the Amazon for a Handful of Beads examines formerly classified contracts between the Ecuadorian military and 16 multinational companies, including the U.S.-based Occidental Oil and Burlington Resources. The article says, quote, the documents prove the Ecuadorian army has become a private security force for oil companies, one obligated to patrol vast swaths of jungle lands while engaging in spying on Ecuadorian citizens opposed to oil operations. It states that these previously unpublished contracts, quote, provide an extremely rare and detailed look at how cutthroat capitalism and an oil-guided militarization of the Ecuadorian Amazon are digging deep rifts through the country. We're joined now by Kelly Hearn, who's on the phone from Buenos Aires. He's the author of the article and a freelance journalist based in the U.S. and South America. We invited a representative from Occidental Oil and Burlington Resources on the program, but they declined our offer. Kelly Hearn, tell us about what you learned and the documents, the contracts that you have seen.
Well, excuse me. I've seen several types, most of them dealing with security links between the Ecuadorian military and the petroleras, the oil firms. But I also had a contract between an oil company and a group of semi-nomadic pre-industrial tribes called the Huarani Indians. And essentially, the Indians gave over access to their oil lands to this multi-billion-dollar oil company for things such as modest allotments of food and medicine, I think a $3,500 schoolhouse, and items such as a soccer ball, a referee's whistle, plates, et cetera. So turning to the military contracts, some of the most egregious provisions were found in an Occidental contract, which basically mandated that Ecuadorian soldiers perform counterintelligence operations to avoid sabotage of oil operations and oil facilities. The backdrop, the political backdrop to all of this, is that there is rising indigenous opposition in eastern Ecuador, in the Ecuadorian Amazon, to these sorts of extractive industries. And as, I don't know if I just got cut off, but, and as this type of political pressure is applied, then clashes between state forces and these indigenous opponents are sure to rise. And it's against that backdrop that these contracts are so worrisome to activists.
Kelly Hearn, I wanted to read to you the statement from Burlington Resources on their website about their work in Ecuador. They say, as corporate citizens, we're committed to managing our operations in Ecuador and elsewhere around the world in a socially responsible manner. This commitment has led us to strive to understand and address the unique needs of the indigenous peoples in Ecuador. We believe the only way to gain access to these blocks is peaceably, through open and honest dialogue with the recognized representatives of the indigenous peoples in the area?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly there are many activists who have worked in Ecuador for quite some time now who will tell you that oil companies are using the sort of historically proven divide and conquer tactic by sending, for example, in some cases, anthropologists who speak the local language, who go into these villages, who promise certain members of the tribes jobs or money, and create political division that way. I will say, too, that activists that I have spoken with have recognized that oil companies, now that their feet are against the fire, have changed some, but there are still many examples of dubious tactics. And I didn't drill down in particular on Burlington, but you know, it certainly sounds good on a website, but I think you would find a completely different scene on the ground there.
Can you talk about the military relationship with Big Oil and Bolivar Beltran, the man from whom you got these documents that had previously not been public?
Sure. Bolivar Beltran is an Ecuadorian attorney and a congressional assessor. He's an aide to congressmen who come from eastern Ecuador, from the Amazonian political districts. And he basically filed a disclosure lawsuit in the name of three congressmen, one of whom I met to help verify these contracts. And so that's how the contracts came to light. One of the Occidental representatives that I spoke with told me that it's likely that these contracts are public anyway, and he disagreed with Bolivar's characterization that they were, you know, kept secret. But you can see clearly if you go to alternet.org and download some of these documents that they're marked classified. So that's how I got the documents. And I will say something about the relationship, the military relationships, which may be a bit surprising. As you know well, from Nigeria to Colombia to Burma, there have been human rights problems along oil pipelines, and you're dealing in many cases with armies who are seen as the repressive minions of these oil firms. I found that many people in Ecuador see the military as a stabilizing force that has peacefully overseen several transitions of government, and that in some cases has actually sided with indigenous opponents to oil when you know, these clashes have come about. Now, there are plenty of stories of military personnel acting on behalf of oil companies and suppressing dissent and intimidating people. But there's also, as I said, a lot of people who see the Ecuadorian army in quite a positive light. What is worrisome to activists is that this is as much about a trajectory as anything. Again, as the indigenous opposition to oil companies rises, you're sure to see clashes, and these sorts of links are worrisome. I would like to add, too, that the contracts that I obtained, some of them were already expired, but on December 8th, the Ecuadorian Minister of Defense declared all contracts with foreign oil firms to be null and void, and he reportedly is designing a new military unit that's responsible for the protection of oil operations.
And Kelly, in this last few seconds, the corporations' names that you found the contracts for.
Well, I found, you know, Occidental was there, Kerr-McGee was there, Burlington was there, but also I should note that Petro Ecuador was there. Chevron is involved in a multi-billion dollar environmental lawsuit for basically having to answer for what Texaco Petroleum did, and Chevron and Texaco merged in 2001.
We're going to have to leave it there. Kelly Hearn, thank you for joining us. That does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire from WDU's John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. Happy birthday, Maddie Harper. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.